Hello, it's Tuesday, the 17th of August. I'm Richard Spur for Andrew Pearce, coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Are you suffering from calorie creep, where tiny amounts of extra calories mean you pile on weight? I'm joined by a top British dietitian to find out more. British homes could soon be burning clean hydrogen gas instead of polluting methane. But are there flaws in the £900 million government plan? I'm joined by an Afghan refugee who went on to graduate from Cambridge and become an NHS doctor, and who is still in touch with colleagues and families in that country. But first, Joe Biden has stood by his decision to withdraw from Afghanistan, blaming soldiers and leaders in the country for the Taliban's resurgence. But what will it mean for Biden and for the world? Joe Biden has blamed Afghan leaders and the country's military for refusing to fight in defence of his decision to withdraw American troops. President Biden said that the buck stopped with him, but has said that he will push ahead with plans to complete the withdrawal by the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 terror attacks. But what will this mean for Biden and for America? Well, I'm joined now by Scott Lucas, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. Professor Lucas, how has this withdrawal reflected on President Biden?
Well, I think in the short term, Biden will take a hit. Part of the reason why he gave the speech last night to the American people was because leading up to the Taliban capture of Kabul and afterwards, especially with those dramatic images, say from Kabul airport, Biden's come under a great deal of criticism, you know, criticism amongst the general public, criticism amongst politicians of both parties, not just Republicans, but his own Democratic Party, not really for the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. We knew that was going to happen, but for the haste and the somewhat chaotic manner of the American withdrawal, not even coordinating that with the Afghan government or the Afghan armed forces. And so the idea is that even if Biden's reasoning keep pouring in more American money, more American troops and resources into Afghanistan was not viable, that to give a date of withdrawal this summer and to leave even by the end of May, withdrawing most American troops, that just simply handed over the keys of Afghanistan to the Taliban.
Do you agree with me and many other pundits, I have to say, that President Biden's attempts to pour oil on very troubled waters were really rather unbelievable?
Well, I'll answer that in two ways. I'll answer that, first of all, with a bit of a personal perspective in terms of reaction to the speech, and then secondly, with the cold reality of politics. My personal perspective last night was that I was almost furious with the speech, and I generally tend to support the Biden administration. And I was almost furious because there was a rewriting of history where Joe Biden said, oh, well, you know, we were there to get rid of the terrorists. And, of course, Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda were not in Afghanistan after 2002. They were in neighboring Pakistan. There was a rewriting of the history subsequent to that in the sense that Biden was part of an Obama administration that tried to build up Afghanistan. Now, that effort in Biden's eyes failed, should not have been attempted. But he, in the end, did pass the buck entirely to the Afghan government, which is corrupt, which is inept, which has been derelict in his duties. But I think overall, the point was that Biden made this an America First speech. He said at the very start this was about American interest in Afghanistan, and not once during the speech did he refer to the Afghan people, those 35 million people who now face an uncertain future under the Taliban. Having said all of that, and my personal almost anger with what happened, I think the cold political reality is that Joe Biden and his advisors, many of whom were in the Obama administration, so they were involved in Afghanistan policy for years, they priced this in. They knew that they'll take a short-term political hit from this, but that after the first Monday in America, Labor Day, attention will probably be elsewhere. The economy, the pandemic, social policy issues, their own priorities of putting forward a record $3.5 trillion budget, and Afghanistan will be far down the list of most Americans' daily reading.
Even as desensitized Western consumers of media, to see those little dots fall from 300 feet from a military aircraft to the ground is galling and shocking.
If I could tell you just a story that links 9/11 to what we saw at Kabul Airport, and that is in one of the iconic images of 9/11 is called Falling Man, and it is about a person in one of the World Trade Towers, a man who, just knowing that he was trapped, there was nowhere to go, jumps out of that skyscraper, falls to his death, and you see him. He's captured against the backdrop of the building as he falls. Now, 20 years later, almost 20 years later, we saw Afghan men fall from the wheels of planes as they desperately tried to get out of the country. My suspicion is that in another 20 years, the falling man outside 9/11 will continue to be an iconic photograph. I'm not so sure as many people will remember or recall, wherever Afghanistan is in 20 years, those men who fell from the wheels of that aircraft yesterday.
How is this going to play internationally for Biden?
I think, in contrast to at home, where I think Biden's not going to take that much of a hit, I think internationally, not just Joe Biden, but the notion of America is going to take a lasting hit. I think you're going to see, in a very practical way, that America has now placed itself as a bystander, not just in Afghanistan, not just withdrawals in Afghanistan, but within the region. I think you will see other countries such as Pakistan and Iran, Afghanistan's neighbors, China beyond that. China, who's already moved to say they want friendly relations with the Taliban, they'll be trying to take political advantage, to take economic advantage. I think you'll see European countries who will look back after Iraq in 2003, after, I think, the failures in the Middle East, particularly in Syria, and now after Afghanistan, I think, really, should we be in lockstep with an American ally where we're not certain that, in fact, they will be there for an international interest, that they'll be America first? And I think just beyond the practical issues of power politics, I think the image of America is taking a real hit. Look, America's a flawed country. America's not perfect. I know that, having grown up there. But there was this image that America stood for values. It stood for something beyond America. It stood for something that we could all aspire to. And for Joe Biden to briefly mention human rights and democracy, but then not once mention the Afghan people who will be suffering the brunt, or who will be at the cutting edge of what we mean by rights and democracy in the near future, I think that shows that those American values that we perhaps assumed were prevalent in the world since 1945 may no longer be center stage.
Thank you for your time. That was Scott Lucas, Professor of International Politics at the University of Birmingham. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Dr. Waheed Aryan was a refugee from Afghanistan and went on to graduate from Cambridge before becoming an NHS doctor. He now runs the charity Aryan Telehealth, which connects doctors in places like Afghanistan with their Western counterparts. He has family who remain in Afghanistan. He joins me now. This must be a very worrying time for you, Dr. Aryan. Just tell me a little bit about what you're hearing from the people who you support.
Thank you so much for having me. Yes, it is very worrying for myself, for my family members who are in Afghanistan, and the colleagues, medical colleagues throughout Afghanistan who are connected to our charity, Aryan Telehealth, and we continue to save lives, including in this recent conflict. Many people have been injured. Thousands of people have been injured and dead already. There are tens of thousands of people who have been displaced internally. I see the pictures firsthand coming from my family members from the park showing what dark conditions they are living in without any basic living necessities such as water, food, and shelter. And there are tens of thousands of other people who are trying to flee to neighboring countries such as Pakistan and Iran. And that's where the international community needs to chip in to provide that humanitarian aid immediately. And yesterday, as soon as I received a text and when I saw the news that the government was toppled, and I burst out crying. It's because it reminded me of my own several war times. In 1992, I was in Afghanistan when President Najib Allah's government was toppled the Mujahideen came in, and it was a bloody civil war that started, that lasted till 1999, till when I was there in Afghanistan. It was a street-by-street fight, because of which we had to flee from one part of the city to another, overstepping dead bodies, dodging bullets and rockets from the top, and hiding in cellars where most of my education happened. And the infrastructure was completely destroyed. Hospitals were destroyed. There was no business, nothing. My father was driving a taxi for 6 months to be able to afford a stack of rice. So that was the life between 1992 all the way to 99 when I was there. And I had to flee for the safety of my own life. And I was in a position where I could support my family. If anything happened to them, I could be the leader of the family. So my father sent me away on my own, age 15, to the UK. And I landed here in the UK as a child refugee with $100 in my pocket, no family support, hardly any education. But it was the compassion of the British government and the British people that first of all gave me safety, allowed me to claim asylum, and then showed me so much kindness that enabled me to study during the day study at night in various colleges in London, work during the day as a cleaner in a shop, as a salesman and kitchen porter. But I still managed to get 5 A's to get to Cambridge University, Harvard, and Imperial until I became a doctor in 2010. But I also brought in the scars of conflict with me, the PTSD, anxiety, and depression with me. Sadly, I didn't know at the time where they were. And yesterday and for the past few days, my symptoms of PTSD have been triggered. I have been hyper alert, having nightmares, thousands of miles away, living in Chester, in a safe house. But those scars will haunt people for decades. So the children that we see now, the people that we see now in dire conditions, they will be haunted mentally as well, of course, beside the physical suffering they have. Hence, when we see refugees, they need to be shown compassion. They need to be treated as humans, both by the government as well as by us people here as well. I've detailed all this in my memoir, In the Wars, just to inform people of what people go through, why they flee, and what actually they do when they arrive. And if I was not given that compassion and safety, I would not be a doctor now serving on the front line of the NHS. I've served throughout the pandemic, saving lives shoulder to shoulder with my other colleagues who were born here.
I'm desperately sorry to hear what you say, both personally and, of course, in the context of your family. When one is a relative in hospital waiting for news of a loved one, a doctor will often come out and say, I think we should expect the worst, but hope for the best. Is that a rationale you apply to your own situation and to the situation of your relatives in Afghanistan?
That's a very important point. So I actually hang on to hope for throughout my childhood, 15 years I was there. So I also was in refugee camp for 3 years in a muddy room. We were living, a family of 8 to 10, with very little. I suffered from malaria with the rest of my family, and I also had tuberculosis, which nearly killed me. That actually inspired me to become a doctor. But throughout it all, 15 years, I had hope that one day there will be some stability, one day there will be brighter day. I didn't know what the future would hold, but I hanged on to hope. So I hope people will not give up on that. And other coping mechanism that I have was to do some exercise as well when people are traumatized. That helps them. But in the current climate, what they actually need is humanitarian aid. They need a helping hand, which I didn't have. Many people didn't have during the Civil War. And hopefully many governments, many people will gather together to start supporting people living in really harsh conditions in conflict zone. And once you give them that safety, that compassion, they will go on to realize their dreams like I did, and they will contribute back to the society. Anyway, we look around, there are immigrants who are contributing to various sectors, whether drivers, shopkeepers, you look at them as your neighbors. So they're all there for a reason to live and to be able to give to each other and to be kind to each other.
Will your charity continue to support people in Afghanistan if the Taliban, and I say if, it looks incredibly likely, the Taliban continue to have ever-increasing control?
We absolutely hope so. Our charity was founded in 2015 by myself because I wanted to connect the compassion of so many of my NHS colleagues who also wanted to help people in conflict zones. I didn't know how to take them there because the situation has never been stable in Afghanistan. So I came across telemedicine and founded this pioneering global charity called Darien Telehu, which connects them now on mobile phones to various cities and provinces throughout the country. They're chatting with each other on WhatsApp. Like you and I are speaking now, they speak with each other without having seen each other and solve problems, save lives on the ground. So this is something that will be beneficial for the Taliban, will be beneficial for the people. And so far, they have allowed humanitarian workers to operate, and they've allowed other sectors to operate as well. And that's what we're hoping for. I'm a humanitarian in heart and by job and my profession. So I will always be an optimist. So I hope we will be allowed to continue, and so many other people will be allowed to continue as well.
And what are your hopes for your family? Would they like to stay there, or would they like to come to the UK?
People don't want to leave their families unless they really, really have to. Like you and I, we all have families. We our hearts will be broken if we are taken away from them, no matter what sort of lifestyle it is that later on we have. So my family members don't want to leave, obviously, unless they have to. So at the moment, they're staying calm. They're hoping for the best. There are obviously people whose lives are at risk, and they are desperately leaving for various reasons that their lives are at risk. But they need to be given that sanctuary. And when they arrive on our shores, whether through the policies, through the British policy or through any other way, most of them may not have the legal ways to come in. So unfortunately, they will have to take very, very dangerous journeys to come here. So hence, we do need to show them that compassion.
Thank you for taking the time. That was Dr. Waheed Aryan of Aryan Terihil. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all of our podcasts, our videos, opinion pieces, and more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at mailplus or at The Spur Show. British homes could soon burn clean hydrogen instead of natural gas under a new plan to create a £900 million hydrogen gas industry in the UK. Hydrogen is considered a key pillar in the quest to make Britain net zero or emitting zero greenhouse gases by 2050, and could fuel lorries, heavy machinery and even planes in the future. Well, joining me now to discuss this is Mike Childs, Head of Science, Policy and Research at Friends of the Earth. Mike, when I was at school, hydrogen was always associated with what we called in the laboratory a squeaky pop, and rather unstable, but it could be the key.
Well, there's no doubt that hydrogen is needed to move forward. We need to move away from fossil fuels. We can see the damage that burning fossil fuels in our cars, in our homes, in planes and elsewhere is having on the planet, with more extreme weather around the world and devastating impacts on people and wildlife. So we definitely need to move away from fossil fuels. Much of our lives can be powered by electricity. Our cars, we can heat our homes predominantly through electricity, and much of industry can be powered by electricity. But there's some areas where hydrogen will be important, and then we kind of need to build that capacity to produce hydrogen in a clean way that helps deliver on the climate challenge, as well as make sure we can power our economy.
What's so good about hydrogen?
When you burn hydrogen, it doesn't release carbon dioxide, therefore it doesn't contribute to climate change and climate challenges. So that's the good thing about hydrogen. The difficult part of the hydrogen equation is you need to manufacture it, and there's two ways of doing it. You can produce it in a clean way, which uses renewable energy and electricity combined with water to split water into hydrogen and oxygen. Or you can try and use natural gas, which you strip the hydrogen out of and try and capture the resulting carbon from that process. That is a dirtier process. It's certainly not net zero in terms of carbon. And it's really not the right way to go, even though the government is saying basically it wants to ride both horses at the moment, both clean hydrogen, so-called green hydrogen, and this dirtier form of hydrogen, which is surprisingly called blue hydrogen.
Surely the only way of getting free hydrogen from water, H2O, is via electrolysis, which one would imagine required electricity. Is that not a little tautologous?
Well, because we can't use electricity to power absolutely everything. Some heavy lorries, for example, will need a different type of fuel, for example. Some industries, such as steel manufacturing, potentially cement manufacturing, can't be powered by electricity. Then we will need a gas to burn, and therefore it makes sense to use electricity to split water into hydrogen and oxygen and use that hydrogen. But you're absolutely right. Where you can use electricity directly, that makes most sense, which is why using electricity to our homes directly makes more sense than trying to produce hydrogen to then pipe to our homes, to then heat our homes.
Why is it so important for the UK to reach net zero by 2050?
Our television screens and our newspapers have been awash over recent months with horrific stories of extreme weather around the world. The heat bubble in the US was astonishing. The floods we've seen in Germany and in China and other parts of the world. And we're seeing increasing floods here in the UK as well. So we know that climate change is causing huge damage. And if we don't get ourselves off burning fossil fuels, and every other country as well, then we're going to see worse to come. So the UK can't solve this problem alone. It needs everybody to play their part. But by implication, therefore, the UK has to play its part. What the UK government can do in this case is try and generate the industries of the future so that we can benefit from that transition, as we are in terms of renewables such as offshore wind. We're now a world leader in that industry. It needs government support to start off with, but now we're a world leader, and it will be a really important export business for us for the future. So there's a positive news story here, as well as trying to avert the dangers of a climate breakdown.
And just finally and briefly, what about the cost in terms of the individual when it comes to travel and utilities? What would that be if we were to switch to hydrogen?
Well, there does come a cost with everything, of course. There's a cost of the damage of extreme weather as well. The government hasn't made clear how it wants to fund this. We're very clear here at Friends of the Earth that the government needs to make sure it's the broader shoulders that foot the bill for this transition. And those broader shoulders include the fossil fuel giants, who make multi-billion pound profits every year and have benefited from the vast amount of fossil fuel use through the ages, despite the damage that's done to our planet. So we'd want to see the burden not fall on the shoulders of those less able to pay, but fall on the shoulders of those who are able to pay.
Mike, many thanks. That was Mike Childs, Head of Science, Policy and Research at Friends of the Earth. Are you falling victim to calorie creep? Overeating by even just 50 to 100 calories regularly, even if it's having an extra apple, can lead to weight gain. Over time, calorie creep can lead to people putting on up to 2 stone a year, often driven by little treats that people don't think about. Well, I'm joined now by Sophie Medlin, founder of City Dietitians and chair of the British Dietetic Association for London. Sophie, can you put a little bit more flesh, if not fat, on the bones of exactly what calorie creep is?
Yeah, of course, Richard. So this is a sort of colloquial term. So there's not a defined use of this term within literature or anything like that. But what we're meaning here, and within this article, what we're referring to is that the way that we sometimes add small things into our diet every day that then can contribute to weight gain over a longer period of time. So it's that extra biscuit you have, or the biscuit that you have with your tea in the morning that then becomes an extra in the afternoon and things like that. And one of the things that we need to recognize around this sort of thing is that it doesn't have to be unhealthy things, in inverted commas, that we're eating that contribute to this sort of thing. So it could be anything that you're having in your diet that just pushes your calorie intake over and above your needs that then contributes to weight gain over time.
Calorie counting became extremely in vogue, if you like, in the 1980s. But surely, subsequently, we've learned that it's all about not having too much carbohydrate and having more protein.
Oh, no. So that's a common misconception. So protein foods are really helpful for keeping us fuller for longer and things like that. But carbohydrates are by no means the devil, and we can certainly include them in healthy, balanced diets. And the healthiest people in the world eat a relatively higher carbohydrate diet than perhaps we even do in this part of the world. So carbohydrates are not the enemy. But calorie counting itself is also not particularly helpful. So when we calorie count too obsessively, we can get really caught up in those sort of few extra calories here and there and things like that that actually don't contribute massively overall. So what we need to really be thinking about and focusing on is avoiding things like obsessive thoughts and feelings about our food, and just really trying not to eat when we're not physically hungry. So listening to our bodies a little bit more is really the most important thing.
When I left university, having been very well fed for 4 years at the age of 22, I was very overweight. And for a man of, 5'10", I was about 16.5 stone. I stopped eating carbohydrates almost completely and ate low fat protein. I lost 6 stones in 6 months. So surely that does work.
It certainly works in the short term for a lot of people, but it's not the right answer for a lot of other people. And we know that lower carbohydrate diets are often associated with increased LDL cholesterol, which is the one that we associate with heart disease and things like that. So as a short-term intervention for some people, some of the time, it's the right thing to do, but it's certainly not a general health recommendation for everybody.
Is it not a fairly common sense equation? It's simply calories in and energy consumed, kcal versus kilojoules. What do people need to do in order to make sure that they don't put on weight?
Yeah, it's certainly when we say it like that, when we say calories in, calories out and calorie deficit and things like that, it sounds like a really simple thing to do. You know, we say things, we bump things around like eat less, move more and things like that. But of course, people's day-to-day lives and all of the conflicting things that we have on our schedules, things like stress and tiredness, all contribute to us feeling hungrier and struggling a bit more with our appetite regulation and wanting to eat more. We also know that people from more deprived communities generally find it more difficult to control their weight for various different reasons. Social deprivation is a really good indicator of risk of obesity. So actually, it's a very, very complex picture. And when we boil these things down to eat less, move more, and these kind of snappy titles, we're really taking away from the complex issues and the wider societal issues that contribute to obesity. So it's far from, it sounds simple, but unfortunately, because humans are complicated and society is complicated, it's actually a complicated thing.
Well, indeed, and we all have different metabolisms, don't we, and different genetics. It strikes me that we in this country are perhaps relatively rather fatter than our European counterparts. Is that a function of our culture and of our lifestyle and the way we eat?
Yeah, absolutely. We have in the UK what we call an obesogenic environment. So our society, our sort of traditions, the way that we conduct our lives generally contributes to more a higher risk of obesity in the UK than in some other parts of Europe. Although the closer we get to adopting a sort of more Western lifestyle in different parts of Europe, we see obesity rates rising quite rapidly in those areas too.
You said something that interests me there about thinking that you're hungry when you're not. And I think often people don't actually drink enough water. You know, that's often something which is suggested to reduce appetite.
Yeah, we need to be careful when we encourage people to drink water instead of eating if they are physically hungry. And one of the things that we often can fall into the trap of is suggesting all these things to suppress appetite. But if you're genuinely physically hungry because you haven't eaten enough, then you are going to be hungry and struggle with your appetite regulation. Things that really do make us hungrier are things like stress and lack of sleep. So we know that people who are sleep deprived eat on average 400 calories a day more than those who are not, or when they are not sleep deprived. So those sorts of factors have a massive impact. And one of the things that I'm always encouraging my patients to do is take time to reflect on whether they are physically hungry or whether they're actually feeling emotionally hungry, or they're lonely, or they're bored, or what else is going on in their life that they're trying to use food to sort of quieten that emotion.
And if you do feel that you're overweight, you feel sluggish, you haven't got a great deal of energy, what's the best way to start to chip away at that? Because it can be a very hard thing to broach, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So weight management is really difficult and complicated, as we've mentioned a couple of times here. And the first thing to do is really to think about what your barriers are to weight loss. So what is it that's getting in your way? Is it that you're always tired and so that's becoming difficult for you in that sense? Is it that you're really stressed and actually going on a strict diet is going to make you feel more stressed and make it more difficult? And what is it that, so what time of day are you most hungry? Is it that you need to put a snack in there? What is it that's kind of contributing to your weight gain? And what is the thing that's the biggest barrier for you to weight loss, and work on that thing? One of the mistakes that lots of people make is deciding that on Monday they're going to go on a really, really strict diet without looking at what's getting in the way of them being successful. And the truth is, we all just need a balanced diet and to be able to eat lots of fruits and vegetables and do lots of healthy things every day. But when we put lots of these strict rules in place, we end up getting things too complicated and too difficult. So what is it that's getting in the way of weight loss, and what can you do to improve it? That's really the best place to start.
Just finally, I mean, many of us lead very, you know, busy lives, and the only place available is sometimes one of those little supermarkets on the corner. And everything there, the snacks, it's either sort of, you know, very high fructose fruit, or it's sandwiches, or it's wraps, and it's all sort of carb-laden. It's very hard to grab a nutritionally sound snack, isn't it, if you are busy?
Yeah, it's certainly more difficult, and this is why we're talking about your environment and how much of an impact that has on your ability to make healthier food choices. So being prepared is something to really try and think about if you are trying to make healthier habits. So if you are thinking, I need to be able to have a healthy snack at 3 o'clock, but I know there's nothing nearby that I can have, what could you keep in at home that you could grab quickly and pop in your bag and take with you, so you've always got something healthier to choose before you go to the shop and have to rely on those less healthy choices?
Sophie, many thanks. That was Sophie Medlin, founder of City Dietitians and chair of the British Dietetic Association for London. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m, you can listen to me all over again. I'm Richard Spur, in for Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have a great evening. Good night.